state investigators have been called in to investigate two deaths near Superior. Good evening, I'm Corin Cates-Carney.
And I'm Conrad Scheid, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Catherine Fry has an update on the effort to reach the controversial Water Compact Agreement on the Flathead Reservation. And in our feature interview, General Manager William Marcus talks to news director Sally Mock, who is wrapping up her last week at Montana Public Radio. State investigators have been called to western Montana to help investigate the death of two people whose body was found at a rural residence near Superior. A neighbor called the Mineral County Sheriff's Office late yesterday morning after spotting a body while checking on the residence at the request of an out-of-town relative who had been unable to reach them by phone. Deputies entered the house and found a second body. The Sheriff's Office asked the Justice Department's Division of Criminal Investigation to help with the investigation. Criminal Justice Department officials say autopsies were planned today at the state criminal lab in Missoula. No other information has been released.
And another news from around the state. A law enforcement officer accidentally shot himself in the leg during firearms training at an Army National Guard shooting range west of Helena. Lewis and Clark County Sheriff's Captain George Cruikshank says the man was participating in an exercise yesterday morning in which officers draw their weapons, fire, and reholster them. The man accidentally shot himself in the right thigh. The officer, whose name and agency were not released, was taken to the hospital in Helena where he underwent surgery. Cruikshank says the man was in stable condition yesterday evening. Montana Army National Guard spokesman Major Tim Crow says because the accident occurred at a guard shooting range, an investigation will be conducted.
While water right lawsuits bounce around from state and federal courthouses, there is technically no legal method of drilling while on the Flathead Reservation, and hasn't been since 1996. Flathead reporter Catherine Fry has more on the latest legal wrinkle on the last reservation in the state with an unsettled water rights agreement.
New wells and water uses have been allowed on the reservation of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes since 1996. Tribal spokesman Robert McDonald says they didn't want to halt progress or development. However, he says there isn't a legally valid way to dig a new well. There's no governing structure in place, so no change of use permits or new well permits. The tribes and the state had come to a water use agreement as part of a nearly two decades-long statewide effort to negotiate water rights settlements with all of Montana's tribes. This is the last of Montana's tribes to reach agreement. The first was reached in 1985 on the Fort Peck Reservation, and the Blackfeet signed an agreement in 2009. The agreement for the Flathead Indian Reservation did not pass the last legislative session. McDonald says they're still working with the state.
We're still committed and engaged in the process to hopefully have a compact that can pass through the legislature in 2015. Tribes are actually upping their efforts to clarify to legislators what is actually in the compact and help nurture understanding of the actual content.
With the failure in the last session, the governor directed negotiations to continue between the states, the tribes, and the U.S. government. The water rights question on the Flathead Reservation is arguably the most complex in the state. Part of the reason for this is the Flathead Indian Irrigation Project. Both tribal and non-tribal members use water from the federal irrigation project. McDonald says multiple lawsuits have been filed against the tribes over water rights. In February, the tribes filed suit in federal court in the face of these suits, which they feel pose a threat to tribal water rights.
The state courts appeared to be engaged in piecemeal adjudication outside the scope of the McCarran Amendment, and we took action to defend our rights.
Last week, State Attorney General Tim Fox's office took several actions in response. It filed friend of the court briefs, asking that the court hold off on ruling until a compact is reached, and describing the state's view that the Montana Water Court, not federal court, has exclusive jurisdiction. Then, spokesman John Barnes says the Attorney General asked the district court to be able to intervene in the lawsuit.
If permission is given to intervene, our ultimate argument will be that the Montana Water Court is the proper court to make a determination on the competing water rights claims and a determination of the ultimate ownership of the water rights that are associated with the Flathead Indian Irrigation Project.
McDonald says the tribes believe the water court is currently extending its jurisdiction over federal subject matter, the federally owned irrigation project. The tribes are concerned about piecemeal litigation undermining the compact process. Barnes says this is a concern shared by the Attorney General's office. but they're also concerned about protecting the integrity of the state water court system.
We want the overarching water issues to be decided through a compact that both sides can agree to, that the legislature will pass. But if that doesn't work, then we believe that Montana Water Court is the appropriate place for these issues to be decided.
Reaching a compact agreement is a goal shared by the tribes. Barnes says the situation with the courts now is to hurry up and wait. And if a compact agreement is reached, many of the points of various lawsuits may become moot. Katrin Fryett reporting from the Flathead.
A steel fabrication plant that began production just north of Great Falls in late January is working to develop a high and wide corridor so it can haul the modules it builds to oil fields and other projects in the region and into Canada. ADF International held a grand opening yesterday at its $26 million steel fabrication building. General Manager Dan Rooney says the plant employs about 80 people and expects to add a second shift in the next several months. ADF also is building a paint shop. Rooney says ADF is finalizing a plan with state and federal transportation officials to complete the final 45 miles of a high and wide corridor by raising 13 utility lines between Great Falls and Fort Benton this summer. The rest of the route into Canada can accommodate the large loads.
The city of Missoula's efforts to gain ownership of the water supply and distribution system that serves its residents through eminent domain has seen several court filings in recent days. The city filed a condemnation action against the global investment firm, the Carlyle Group, on April 2nd to gain ownership of the Montana Water Company. On Tuesday, the Carlyle Group filed documents saying it does not directly own the water supply system and cannot be named as a defendant. Carlyle argues it owns the companies that own the mountain water, but does not own the mountain water system. A group of 28 mountain water company employees filed a motion yesterday to intervene the city's suit, saying that they were concerned what the condemnation might mean for their job security and accrued benefits.
The state of Montana's newest employee health center opened today in Missoula, the fourth in the state. The Missoula office on South Reserve Street joins other health centers in Helena, Miles City, and Billings. Former Governor Brian Schweitzer first proposed the government-operated primary care clinics for state workers and their families several years ago. Department of Administration Director Shayla Hogan says the idea is to provide primary care services that will eventually lead to lower prices.
It could be a wellness check. It could be a treating a cold, treating some type of illness that you might have. It depends on your individual situation. What do you need? And we're here to help you. And it's about providing the best health care possible to our employees, but also controlling costs.
Hogan says prevention is key.
We're hoping that by getting people in, recognizing illness up front, controlling diabetes possibly, or prevention, those types of things. Try to catch things up front before they become a chronic illness.
The Montana Health Centers have only been operating since 2012, and Hogan says it's too soon to know how much, if any, healthcare savings have already been realized. Lieutenant Governor Angela McLean attended today's grand opening and said these health centers are just one way the state wants to demonstrate its appreciation for all the work state employees do.
And by creating opportunities for easy access to healthcare for you and your families, I think is critical for you to understand and fully comprehend the appreciation that we have for you and for your families and for their health. I think it's so remarkable that Montana would take the lead in the country and be the first state in the nation to open employee health centers as a way to improve the health of state employees in the manner that we have.
McLean says nearly 26,000 visits were recorded at the Helena, Montana Health Center last year.
Business owners in the downtown areas of Billings and Missoula are searching for solutions to the increased trouble they're having with transients and panhandlers. Missoula has an ordinance against panhandling, pedestrian interference, and aggressive panhandling, but some business owners say the consequences aren't severe enough to discourage the behavior. Some are calling for fines and possible jail time for repeat offenders. The city rejected a stricter ordinance after a federal judge in Idaho ruled that asking for money is protected speech. In Billings, the Downtown Billings Alliance met yesterday to discuss similar issues with public intoxication and transients. The city's downtown resource officers say the number of responses to drunken and disorderly has increased, as has the number of citations for open containers. Billings Mayor Tom Hanel suggested moving some services for the homeless away from the downtown area.
A proposed ballot initiative to ban marijuana use and possession in Montana has cleared a legal review. But sponsor Steve Zabawa will only have 3 weeks to collect the 24,175 voter signatures needed to get the measure on the ballot in November. The Secretary of State's office approved the measure for signature gathering today after the Attorney General decided it was legally sufficient. The plan calls for repealing Montana's medical marijuana law and barring any Schedule I drug listed in the Federal Controlled Substances Act, which includes marijuana. Zabawa owns a car dealership in Billings. His proposal says the intent is to eliminate the disparity between federal and state law in possessing and using marijuana. There were about 8,500 registered medical marijuana users in the state at the end of April.
The former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio, Gregory Pfeiffer, is in Missoula to lecture about his new book titled Russians, the People Behind the Power. Pfeiffer covered Russia for NPR from 2005 through 2009. He says many Russians, including President Vladimir Putin, want to regain their lost superpower status. Pfeiffer believes Putin's insertion into Ukraine is an effort to feed that nationalism.
For Putin, this is about resurrecting the Cold War, destabilizing the country in order to be able to exert influence, also in order to oppose the West. Say, I'm going to do what I want in my backyard, and there's nothing you can do about it. And his approval ratings are now, once again, above 80%.
Pfeiffer says Putin is a master of appearances who likes to keep outsiders, especially the West, guessing.
I think from the very beginning, he's had a lot of anti-Western rhetoric. He's used the West as a way of generating support for himself by casting it as the outside enemy. There were moments of détente, let's say, after September 11th, for example. Putin was the first world leader to call President Bush. But those were just moments. I think he's been very consistent from the very beginning.
And Pfeiffer believes Putin's resurrection of the Cold War is bad not only for Russia, but for the rest of the world.
Putin is actually compromising European security. He has redrawn European borders for the first time in decades. And it's terrible for Russia. Russia needs to join the rest of the world.
Pfeiffer will give a free public lecture about Russia tonight at 7 o'clock in the Del Brown Room of Turner Hall on the University of Montana campus.
A proposed coal swap involving Montana's Northern Cheyenne Tribe has been approved by a U.S. House committee, despite concerns raised by the panel's ranking Democrat. The Committee on Natural Resources today approved the Northern Cheyenne Lands Act by a voice vote. The measure from Montana Republican Representative Steve Daines seeks to fix a mistake made in 1900, when the government expanded the Northern Cheyenne Reservation but failed to acquire the underlying minerals. Houston-based Great Northern Properties would get 112 million tons of publicly owned coal in exchange for giving the tribe an estimated 117 million tons beneath the reservation. Oregon Democratic Representative Peter DeFazio says there's no way to know if the exchange is fair because the value of the properties has not been assessed.
Tomorrow is a red-letter day for Montana Public Radio News, after more than three decades as our news director Sally Mock is retiring. She's logged hundreds of hours of interviews, on-the-scene fire coverage, long, frantic election nights, and news-poor holidays. She sat down with NTPR General Manager William Marcus today to reflect on her career. And although the tables were turned, she still asked the first question.
So, William, what are you going to ask me?
Yeah, everybody who has sat here and had the mics opened and talked to you, I think, have always wondered what you are going to ask, because it's never predictable. It's always informed. And I think people appreciate that and in some ways are intimidated by it a bit. But before we get to that, it's your last week here. So let's dial it back 34 years.
Oh, my gosh.
You were coming out of the Forest Service at that time, right?
Yeah, I'd been a wilderness ranger.
And why did you end up at Montana Public Radio, KUFM, at the time?
This is being in the right place at the right time story. Jill Hoyt was news director then, and she had a show where she focused on issues of the day, and one of the issues was mining in the wilderness. And that was an issue in the wilderness area I was working in. And so she had me on her program with a forest supervisor from the Kootenai Forest. And we talked about mining in the wilderness. And afterwards, Jill said to me, "Oh, you were so good. I wish we could hire you or something." And I said, "Well."
As a matter of fact.
As a matter of fact, because the job I had at that time, the funding had run out for it. And I was looking for a change and looking to move to Missoula. And
why radio? I mean, other than it's just a job, there must have been something intriguing.
I think the idea of being a journalist appealed to me at that time. I really was always interested in politics and interested in the world, and it seemed like it was going to be a natural fit, but I knew squat about radio and squat about journalism, actually, and I think in the beginning, frankly, I was pretty bad at it. Luckily, KUFM hung in there with me.
How has it changed over the years? I mean, if you look back, the issues are pretty much the same in many ways, aren't they?
They are. I think how they're debated and how the issues are dealt with have changed a lot, not necessarily for the better. I think in the beginning that the issues, as you say, are often the same. I mean, it's jobs versus the environment. It's what should Montana do to be economically, have an economically bright future? How do you preserve what everyone comes to Montana for? That will always be an issue in this state. But how it's debated has changed, and I think the level of debate, frankly, has gotten less than it should be. I hope that what I've done over the years is try to add to that debate and raise the level of it and show the complexity of the issues, that they aren't black and white, and that I'd say the vast majority of people on all sides of the issue are good-hearted people who care about the state deeply.
And I believe that too, but why do you think it has gone to such partisanship and such extremes of people talking past each other or yelling at each other?
It's hard to know for sure, but I think a part of it is that we are so bombarded with information now, and we have access to so many things that the complexity gets diluted and the rhetoric gets escalated because there's so many more forums for people to vent and to find each other of like mind and not listen to someone who might not have the same opinion but might have something that would be interesting to listen to. And it just has gotten more fuel to the fire, I think, of people who think alike, and then they sort of feed on somebody comes up with some sort of notion about something and it takes hold, and it's not a correct notion necessarily, but people take hold of it and they can't let go of it. I think part of it is that.
When people hear something that is balanced, that has both those voices in it, they no longer identify in any way with a side different from their own because it— Why? Because people don't want to do the work?
I think it is partly that you do have to make an effort. It's not something that, you know, you shouldn't leave it up to other people to tell you what to think, number one. But it's easier to do that, to have somebody say, vote this way, do this, and then go off and do it. It's much harder to think about what are the nuances of this issue and what does it mean, not for the short term, but for the long-term future. And to be able to look long-term, I think we're all, maybe it's partly that we're all into immediate gratification. And a lot of these issues mean you have to delay gratification if you want to do the right thing. And that's hard. And maybe sacrifice something, which is even harder.
Right. And I think you have people who sit at this table with you. They no longer expect to be challenged by the media. And you are not intimidated by really anybody who sits at this table. What are you thinking when you're calling someone to task?
I'm thinking I'm doing my job. That's my job. That's what I'm paid to do. And that's what I'm going to do. And it should be their job to be challenged and be able to answer that challenge and articulate what they stand for.
Some of the messages that we've gotten from folks have been community leaders, politicians. And to a person, they have appreciated that straightforward, tough questioning, because I think they believe that it is parceled out equally to both sides. How do you balance that kind of exchange?
I look at their records. I look at what they voted for. I look at what they say. And I asked him about that and whether they're a Democrat or Republican or a Libertarian or a Tea Party or whatever. I just look at what they have said in public, what they have done, and ask them about that. And sometimes when those things don't match, they probably think that I'm being intimidating in my questions, but I think I'm asking fair questions all the time and trying to think also what is best going to inform the audience about who this person is and what they stand for.
And beyond the politicians and those kind of guests, you have become best known in the last few years anyway for your in-depth interviews with the people who come through the university for the president's lectures or come to Missoula for any kind of public forums. The popularity of those, I think, comes from your research and your just sort of curious approach to them. How do you do your own research, your own interests, but make sure that it's going to be interesting to the people who are listening? It can be a very interior conversation, I would think, but
it
they
is,
aren't.
And I'm not sure I've hit it every time either, yeah, as I should have, but it's been so great in this job to meet so many interesting, smart, diverse people and to get to sit down with them and ask them anything I want. I mean, I'm well aware of what a privilege that has been, and I've tried not to abuse that privilege and have it be just, well, what does Sally Mock want to know? But I do try to think, what would the audience most like to glean from this person and what they have written about or lectured about or done in their life, and whether it's an artist or a politician or an academic who has expertise in some area, try to think what the audience would most like to know about what they've done. And they've usually done such interesting things or written such interesting things or painted something beautiful that it's just easy enough to ask them about that.
When you go out to dinner, do you just ask people questions all the time?
My friends would some say that I interview them sometimes a little too much, probably. It's a habit hard to break.
During Public Radio Week, we played some of your favorite moments over the years. What are a couple of the outstanding moments you've had as a
journalist? That's probably the question I get asked the most, yeah, is what was your favorite interview? And because I've done thousands, mm-hmm, it's impossible to narrow it down to even a handful. But, you know, honestly, William, one of the interviews I still think about to this day was early in my career here. A Japanese woman came through who had survived Hiroshima and lost all her family and herself had leukemia. And she was now a peace activist, logically. And she had absolutely no bitterness in her about that. And I remember when she walked out, I thought, that's what grace looks like. And I'll never forget talking to somebody like that.
The ability to bring that story to others, I think, is the wonderful power of what we do in broadcasting. And you have been a model of that power. And I want to thank you for all those years of wonderful radio. And our listeners are going to miss you very much.
Well, thank you, William. And you've always stood behind me. And that was terribly important. Thank you.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, tonight looks mostly clear with lows in the 30s. Friday should remain sunny with highs in the 70s. In central Montana, tonight it will be mostly clear. Low should be about 35 to 45, with gusts of up to 45 miles per hour in the evening. On Friday, expect sunny skies with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and highs from 70 to 75. In southwest Montana, tonight should be mostly clear with lows from 35 to 40. On Friday, you can expect increasing clouds with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and highs in the lower 70s. And now for the editorial comments of Shelby DeMars.
Shelby DeMars with Count on Coal Montana, a coalition advocating for increasing Montana's coal production to provide new jobs and opportunity for our state and to supply the world with affordable energy. I'd like to talk about two of the most serious problems facing us today, climate change and energy poverty. Both are big, difficult challenges, and they're so inextricably intertwined that we can't discuss one without the other. First, what are the facts? The data shows us that climate change is happening. Most scientists agree that if CO2 concentrations continue to increase, the planet will suffer negative consequences. But to be clear, those dangers aren't predicted until almost 100 years from now. The data also show that 3.5 billion people, roughly half the world's population, lack proper access to electricity, and 1.2 billion of those have no access at all. The data also show that power from renewable energy does not currently have the capacity to supply even a small fraction of the energy needs for those people, much less the needs of our own country. And that's not the fossil fuel industry saying that. That's the reality outlined by our own Federal Energy Information Administration and the International Energy Agency. Our government forecasts that even if we continue to pour massive taxpayer subsidies into renewable energy, they will still be able to supply only 10% of our domestic energy demand by 2040. In that year, coal will continue to supply about the same amount of our energy as it does today. It's true that solar and wind power are growing at a great pace in the United States and around the world. But last year, the worldwide increase in coal generation was bigger than that of all renewable resources combined. The problem isn't that we're not spending enough on renewables. In truth, we're spending massive amounts. It's that the demand for energy is so enormous that these technologies can't keep pace. To suggest, as many well-meaning environmental activists do, that we can somehow shut down fossil fuel generation and replace it with renewables in the near future is to deny both the data and the science. Around the world, we need more energy, and the fact is a substantial part of that energy will be supplied by coal and other fossil fuels. Moreover, the anti-energy agenda has profound negative consequences in our country. It threatens jobs and would artificially increase the price we pay for energy and substantially slow economic growth. And in the developing world, that anti-energy agenda has the potential to relegate billions of people to energy poverty, affecting their access to health care, education, and a simple modern life. To summarize, we have a climate problem that requires us to reduce carbon emissions, but we also have an energy poverty problem that should be addressed and will be whether we want it to or not. That means the world will continue to consume increasing amounts of coal. The only realistic path forward is to focus on ways to make current methods of energy generation cleaner. Carbon capture and storage is one promising technology, but President Obama has put a de facto ban on developing carbon capture and storage through EPA regulations. American scientists and engineers are watching from the sidelines as we rely on others to tackle this problem. Montana has more coal than just about anywhere else in the world. Nowhere is there more opportunity to create great jobs and grow our economy. Let's be the leaders in solving climate change by developing clean coal technology. And let's be the leaders in solving energy poverty by supplying Montana coal around the world where it's needed most.
Shelby DeMars is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Corin Cates Carney.
And I'm Conrad Scheid. Thanks for listening, and please join Editor O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.